Welcome to the Wild West Podcast, where today I'm very excited to welcome my guest, Jason Scorse, a professor of environmental studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies down in Monterey. Jason is an economist, but I think of him as basically a coastal futurist. He's someone who thinks creatively about the ways that we've chosen to develop the coast and live there, and so I wanted to talk to him about how our relationship to the coast is going to have to change, specifically in the face of climate change.
So we have never had a rational, scientific, healthy, just relationship with the oceans. It's been one extreme to the other. All, you know, throw all the poor people there or kick them out and put our house up to the last inch on the cliff.
Jason runs the Center for the Blue Economy, which is a think tank that's trying to figure out how we find some kind of healthy, sustainable equilibrium with the ocean. So that could mean changing the ways we build homes on the beach. It could mean rethinking commercial fishing practices. It could mean returning large sections of coast to nature. We talk about a lot of fun stuff in this podcast. For instance, the idea that cities and towns on the coast need to start strategically retreating from the water's edge inland or risk massive financial losses. That can mean instituting some kind of government buyout program so that homeowners can afford to relocate. But we don't really know because nobody's really doing it. But it's something that towns are going to have to start thinking about sooner rather than later. So Jason and I, we cover that. We cover a lot more. As you'll hear, he's super knowledgeable, which is why I love talking to him. We'll get to our conversation in just 1 minute, but first this brief message. All right, we're back. Now on to my conversation with Director for the Center for the Blue Economy, Jason Scorse. Welcome to the podcast, Jason.
Great to be here.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing great.
So we're recording at your house, which I'm not going to give the location of it, but showing up here made me wonder. The last time we saw each other, I think, was about 6 years ago. It was when I was working on a story about surfonomics and specifically research that you were working on that was going to show that the home prices in Santa Cruz are pegged directly to the proximity to good surf spots. So we were walking around and looking at homes, but you were actually at the time looking for a new house, right?
Correct. And in fact, I bought this house just about then. It's about a little over 6 years old.
Oh, interesting. And so if you wouldn't mind real quick kind of recapping, what'd you find in your research into the real estate market in Santa Cruz?
Sure. So what we found was a pretty strong correlation between beach homes that were near really good surf breaks and about, you know, on average, about $100,000 premium for those homes. We're pretty confident about those results. Again, it was the first paper to look at that. Mm-hmm. It was about $100,000, you know, to be near a nice surf break, you know, where you can walk out the door and go surfing.
What interested me about the research that you did is that you found that it wasn't just being near a nice beach. It was being near surfing specifically and quality surfing specifically. If the research had just shown like, oh, if you're near the beach, hey, if your house has a nice view, like it'll be worth more. That's pretty self-explanatory. But this actually looked at being near a surf break because you were looking at like Pleasure Point specifically. There's not really a beach there. You don't really hang out at Pleasure Point. And so that was what I thought was fascinating about that.
Yeah, correct. So, you know, you have to find pretty unique conditions to do a study like this because, like you said, you know, we're trying to tease out just the contribution of surfing. Yeah. So Pleasure Point was perfect because, like you said, it's not a beach that people hang out on and do anything. You know, there is a little walkway there for walking, which is nice, people with their dogs and stuff. But in terms of the beach, it's almost non-existent. There's no volleyball. There's no sun tanning. There's no swimming. It's really a surf break and nothing else. And then we have beaches close by that are the exact opposite, that are really big, wide open, nice kind of hanging out beach, but no appreciable surf. You know, maybe on a big day, there's a couple breaks, but by and large, they're pretty flat all the time. And so that contrast is what allowed us to do the comparison and get something meaningful statistically.
Yeah, that was great. So, and then kind of bring me up to speed. What have you been working on in the interim here?
Sure. So most of my work has been with the Center for the Blue Economy, which when we last spoke was only, you know, it was really in its infancy. It was in the first couple of years. We're just getting going. And so we've really ramped up. We've hired some research staff. We've started an international journal. We've got, you know, now a number of cohorts of students that have kind of gone through. And the two main research projects of the center are helping governments around the world kind of develop ocean economic accounting systems, which is obviously a pretty niche and kind of, not your typical type of economic analysis, but it's trying to look at the contribution of ocean resources to economic health. And in doing that, we're also trying to define the blue economy. The World Bank defines the blue economy as kind of the sustainable use of ocean and coastal resources. Then, of course, the follow-up question is, what is sustainable? And that's what we're really trying to operationalize. To make it simple, you know, we want to be able to tell governments, tell, you know, finance ministers, you know, offshore oil, unsustainable, offshore wind, sustainable. Mm-hmm. Offshore fin fish pens, unsustainable, offshore plant-based aquaculture, sustainable. You know, onshore natural living infrastructure for climate protection, sustainable, seawalls, not, right? So we're trying to really, and again, and we probably will never get to that level of specificity across the board because, you know, the coastal environments are just too varied around the world, but just some general principles to really kind of carve out what the blue economy looks like, how to measure it. So that's kind of the meta part one. And then we're really doing a lot of projects on climate adaptation, kind of the economics of how we adapt to climate change. Because, you know, one of the big buzzwords right now is climate resilience, and that's kind of the evolution. And there's some strength to that term and that word, and it's probably a more affirmative word. But it also, I think, masks a lot because we're really not going to be able to keep what we currently have, right? So resilience, I think, kind of portrays a little bit more of status quo than is probably likely to occur. Whereas adaptation, I think, is probably the more accurate term of, because we're going to have to move around a lot and we're going to have to do things very differently. And so there's obviously a lot of economic questions with that, right? When cities and towns and states are making decisions now, they're siting a new road, they're putting a sewage treatment plant, a new development project. These things are supposed to last 50, 100 years. And so their longevity is entering into some pretty uncertain space in terms of climate change, especially in low-lying areas.
Yeah.
And so we're really trying to help with kind of the economics of that decision-making.
I want to ask you about some of your work at the center, but since you touched on it right then, that's really what is interesting. One of the things that's interesting me these days when I'm thinking about coastal issues in California. California coast is this iconic feature of the country, and the way that we people who live here have to conceive of how we occupy that space and what we do there, how we develop it, all has to change. And that's happening at this point right now where a bunch of these coastal towns are creating their 30-year plans. And so I'm reading about different pieces of these, and it's interesting to read just kind of how each area is dealing with this kind of on a psychological level almost, because what everything points to is you can build seawalls and jetties and all of these things that are designed to kind of shore up the coast and keep it from being eroded and keep sea level rise from affecting certain properties. But really, at the end of the day, it sounds like the big decision that's going to have to be made for these places is managed retreat, is the term I keep seeing, which is basically we're just going to have to start moving inland. Like, we just can't build on the bluffs with the views anymore. We got to move away. Have you talked to anybody about, like, have you had experience with local municipalities or decision makers in these areas? What are they thinking? What are they saying?
Yeah, so we have. And in fact, we're working with a lot of the local municipalities that are dealing with this exact issue. And to be honest, as progressive as California is, this is one area where we are still really behind the curve. People, the kind of the private property ethic of this is my piece and I'm not giving it up under any circumstances is still very strong, and people are very stubborn. And I do say that with precisely, because it's stubbornness in the face of physics and science that is, you know, doesn't care whether you believe it or not,
yeah.
Right? And doesn't care about your feelings. And there's a lot of resistance. There's city councils that are being voted out because they mention the word managed retreat, yeah, in a document, and real risk aversion to even using this language. People are trying to come up with new language. So it's incredibly contentious, incredibly difficult. And maybe I'll kind of take a meta angle here for a second. And this is some of the stuff that I'm working on now too, which is, if you think about it in U.S. history, obviously we're a relatively young country. And we've never had a healthy relationship with the oceans. We've had two pendulum swings. So the first was, and most people don't realize this, is that in the beginning of the nation's history, the poor people all lived at the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Rich people thought the coast was, you know, disgusting. It was smelly. Yeah. It was variable. It was where all the kind of fish and seaweed and bugs, and it was kind of chaotic. And so they lived up in the hills away from floods where they could look out over everything. And it was the immigrants and the slaves and the poor people who lived on the coast. And so then, you know, in basically the end of the 19th, early 20th century, that changed. There's a lot of reasons for that. But then wealthy, particularly wealthy whites, got very interested in the coast. And there's huge history about incredible injustice done to basically forcibly remove these people. There's still communities up and down the coast that are, have the scars of that from over 100 years ago. Even here in progressive Santa Cruz, Monterey, Chinese communities were just forcibly removed. There's from what I hear is there's still Asian communities in San Jose whose, you know, whose people, they refuse to even visit Monterey and Santa Cruz because of the harsh memories of their ancestors being violently removed, right? So then what did we do? We moved all the way up to the edge. So once we got it, we said, we want to be right at the edge and put our house right there on the dunes, destroy all the wetlands, destroy the marshes, all that nasty stuff with the bugs, and put the house right up there. So that's the history of U.S. coastal policy for, you know, hundreds of years. So we have never had a rational, scientific, healthy, just relationship with the oceans. It's been one extreme to the other. All, you know, throw all the poor people there or kick them out and put our house up to the last inch on the cliff. And so the reason I mention this is because this is a big paradigm shift, right? We really don't understand what the coasts are, and we don't appreciate what we've done to them. And we don't appreciate what's going to need to happen. The upside to this is it's a big opportunity. It's an opportunity to kind of finally do it right. And if we do it right, I can envision a pretty prosperous coastal environment going forward. So it doesn't have to just be a negative, but I don't think we're there yet. It's still viewed as kind of negative and cost, and I'm not going to move my house because this is where my grandma lived or whatever.
Yeah.
And we haven't really evolved into that new way of thinking, which is kind of part of the work we're trying to do.
So before we get into the new way of thinking or the things that you'd like to see, what is a common rationale that you are hearing for why we shouldn't move, or we shouldn't think about this, or we shouldn't deal with this right now?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, again, I use the word stubbornness purposely because I think it's really just a stubborn insistence that we you know, we need to do whatever it takes to protect our, you know, our current property. That, you know, with enough riprap, enough seawall, you know, enough reinforcements, we can figure it out. And, you know, that's what Americans do. We're tough, we're strong, we stand up, we protect what's ours. So really, there aren't very many good rationales. So that is the one we hear the most. I don't think it's particularly persuasive, but that seems to be the psychology it's coming from. And let me be also clear, like, I get it to some degree, right? Nobody wants to be told that their property is, you know, permanently at risk and that they have to move. And a lot of these people have invested a lot, and many of them are multi-generational. So again, I'm not entirely unsympathetic to the view. But it, you know, it's not constructive, though, to just insist, and while the science gets worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm. So what would you like to see? What do you think we should be doing? Because you've talked about private homes that are on the coast, but in some of the areas, like, you're drawing lines around, like, schools and churches and businesses, and it's not just, like, rich people's homes right on the bluffs. It's kind of entire pieces of infrastructure for these communities that are going to have to be relocated, or something is going to have to be changed. So what would you like to see going forward? How do we kind of address that?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, with the caveat to start here, there's no kind of one size fits all or anything like that. But in terms of some general principles, I'd say the first thing is we should take the opportunity for managed retreat to restore the natural infrastructure of the coastline. So this means putting back, restoring, you know, seagrass, wetlands, you know, in some areas of the country, mangroves, dune systems. And that can be produce a lot of really good jobs. So I just want to say there's going to be a whole new industry, you know, being given birth here for kind of ecological restoration on the coastal zones. This is going to take everything from PhD scientists to manual laborers to, you know, and then I'd say we want to build in some new economic opportunity in there, right? So you want to start thinking about new waterfront properties, new kind of living and working waterfronts, new models for how people interact with the coast. So maybe all the infrastructure and the parking lots aren't right up to the edge of the beach. We restore all that, we move everything back, but then we can put in, you know, really detailed trail systems and park systems and bike lanes and make the coastal, this new really restored coastal infrastructure a much more integrated part of the community. It's not just, you know, one little parking lot or one rich neighborhood or something like that. So that'd be one, I'd say that's probably the first thing is restoring the coastal ecology. The second I would say is the justice aspect, right? Is that,
yeah,
you know, environmental justice finally is getting its due in the sense that people realize that there's a lot of inequities and unfairness going on with the way pollution is distributed, the way with environmental impacts are distributed. And I think that in the coastal zones, we're going to see this as well. And you're right to point out that it's not just rich people that live on the coast. There's all kinds of public infrastructure and middle-class homes, et cetera. And so I think people whose homes have to be destroyed or moved, some levels of compensation, some levels of buyouts, maybe they get preference for new land, maybe they get a bigger lot size, maybe they get some tax breaks because that's put into some kind of conservation easement. So I'd say, you know, more creative financial instruments to make it fair. Now, when I say fair, that doesn't mean everybody is going to be 100% whole, right? So yeah, people whose properties are most at risk are probably going to have some negative economic consequence, but it doesn't have to be devastating, right? And I think people, if we do this right and in a deliberative fashion, people can come out feeling like they were treated well and that this overall, the community is better off, even if, you know, they, you know, some of their property had to kind of be sacrificed in this transition period.
Hmm. So you'd like to see some kind of real cohesive, comprehensive coastal management plan that kind of takes all of these different interests into account.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, some communities are really starting to do this, or at least having those initial conversations. I don't think there's any that have a fully flushed out plan that's kind of on paper. But, you know, this, we're in the early stages here, even if maybe the time horizon isn't that long. We still are, you know, just kind of getting going here. And I'm confident, if we put it this way, if we can't do it in California, we're not going to be able to do it anywhere.
Right.
So we really have to be kind of models and leaders in this field like we are in many others.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned that I wanted to ask you, but I wanted to follow up on, and I don't want to go too far down this road, but I think about a year ago, the California Coastal Commission approved an environmental justice policy, I think is what they called it. Mm-hmm. And essentially it was kind of, from what I gather, it's sort of a public announcement that the Coastal Commission is going to start taking into account access needs for low-income people, people of color, people who have by and large kind of been overlooked or excluded from the coast, from accessing the coast. Because as we know, it's like, it's not like there are a bunch of cheap motels lining the California coast. Like, it's big, fancy hotels, it's wealthy developments, and a lot of those, the private property holders are doing everything that they can to kind of carve out their section of the coast, even though it's supposed to be open to the public, and keep people out of it. So I'm just curious if you can talk about that a little bit, what you see as being maybe the opportunity that we have right now to open the coast in a new way.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about that Coastal Commission kind of ordinance is that it really, this is supposed to have been part of the Coastal Commission's mandate for
right.
a long time.
Right.
So it's kind of almost like they were,
it was just symbolic,
I think. Yeah, re-stipulating or maybe more forcefully articulating what's something that's really been part of their mandate. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think it's a good thing to point out. And, you know, the Coastal Commission, I'll give them credit that they really have done a lot to fight these, you know, these billionaires who block public access, and they usually win, right? And a lot of, you know, you can go to other parts of the country, go up in New England where there's a lot of private beaches where you can drive for a long time without access, and then you drive down California highways and it's, you know, every couple miles there's a big open public beach for free. And really appreciate that they have done a pretty good job. So
yeah.
So overall, you know, I just think they were probably just planting their flag a little. they're seeing where the wind's blowing, that environmental justice is a big deal, and just kind of re-articulating something that I think they've been reasonably adept at for a long time.
Yeah. So what do you think prospective home buyers on the coast should be thinking about right now?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, I mean, you know, if we're only talking California, that's one thing, but I'd say there's a lot of parts of the United States where I would just say, do not buy anything.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I would never buy any property in Miami. I can tell you, I can say this with 100% confidence. People in Florida are going to lose tens of billions of dollars. Period. Done. Another big hurricane or two, and it's that market's going to collapse. And there's a lot of political ramifications of that that will fall into place. Because, you know, there's a high likelihood actually that Florida, will, state of Florida, will go bankrupt under those scenarios. But that being said, you know, California is a lot different. The first thing I would just say is I don't think anyone should be right up to the edge of the water, right? That's just not a sensible thing to do. If in 2019 you're building property right at the edge of the water, A, ecologically, that's not a good thing to do, and B, even if it's well fortified and even if it's on a cliff, I just think you're putting yourself at big financial risk.
And that's what you're talking about is erosion, essentially. And on the lower lying areas, sea level rise.
And yeah, and then of course they combine, right? And they can. But you know, a lot of the properties that are most at risk are high up on cliffs, you know, they're eroding and then falling apart. And again, when you're recessed 10 feet back from the edge of the cliff, it's just a matter of time before you're going to be impacted. And you know, I obviously could not afford on my professor's salary to buy my house right on the cliff. But even in that case, I wouldn't have. And on this property that I purchased is up on a hill. And I am very far away from, you know, any imminent climate change impacts. I'm sure the next ice age or whatever, my ancestors will have to figure something out.
So your work for the Center of the Blue Economy is essentially promoting this idea of the blue economy, and then within that larger national framework of the Green New Deal. And you touched on that earlier, but what does that actually look like? How can we sort of integrate or incorporate these principles into this broader kind of national policy framework?
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that because we're working. That's my main project for the next year, actually. So we have what's called the Ocean Climate Action Plan is our project title. And we are actually convening leaders in California in October to kind of begin this work of really outlining priorities for integrating kind of ocean and coastal issues into a national framework. So this work we're doing, our hope is to have something by spring of next year. And we have an article I can send you, and you can link to it if you want, you know, for your listeners, on kind of the 8 principles that we're starting out to look at. So it's everything from coastal infrastructure to disaster response to offshore renewable power to plant-based aquaculture development. We're really far behind the rest of the world in that, and that's some of the most sustainable food supplies and climate-resilient food supplies. So it's a pretty broad, comprehensive package. Our hope is to get a consensus kind of document put together that's pretty well fleshed out, that has all the leaders of the ocean community in the United States backing it, or at least the majority, and then to bring them to the presidential candidates. We'll bring them to the Trump administration too. It would be great if they took them on as well. We're happy for anyone to do that. And so this is a kind of a to be determined here. We have, I think, the basic principles of the framework. There's also some great legislation that's already been introduced. Again, it's not going anywhere in the Senate under McConnell. But Kamala Harris and I think Ed Markey, they have a Living Shorelines Act that they've introduced in the Senate. So there's little pieces of it. What we're trying to do is kind of put it all together. And then in the hopes that leadership changes, or the current leadership becomes enlightened, that then maybe in 2021 some of this will actually come into effect.
Yeah. One of those principles, or an idea in one of those principles that I read about, I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned natural coastal infrastructure and then living shorelines. I just wanted to ask, what are those and what role do they play?
Yeah. So, you know, those in some ways are kind of the synonymous here. It kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, there's a lot of science showing, and we've actually done some of this work as well, that, you know, a dune, a marshland, an oyster reef, will give better coastal protection than a seawall or, you know, a kind of hardened gray infrastructure. And but then, of course, it comes with all the environmental benefits as well, because it's habitat for creatures and fish and birds and invertebrates. And so the thing that's really the impediment right now is not necessarily the economics. People say, oh, well, that must be so much more expensive. It actually turns out that it's not in most areas. But there's just not very good understanding of it. There's not a lot. There aren't engineering firms, you know, that can give you the deep specs that they can with a seawall. And so a lot of the work here is just kind of building the kind of scientific and infrastructure so that you're a homeowner or you're a developer or you're a city that's building, you know, a library or a school or something in a low-lying area, and you can go and say, hey, I want to protect this with living, you know, shoreline, living infrastructure. We don't want to do the gray stuff. And there be specs ready that are developed with costs and maintenance and all that, that they can compare against the alternatives and say, oh, wow, that's cheaper. Of course, I want to go with that. And then obviously building in some of the maybe the tourism or, you know, the other kind of recreational opportunities around that. And then that would be kind of an additional benefit.
Are there any specific projects or specific towns or municipalities along the coast that you think are success stories, case studies that you would point to, areas that are doing it right, essentially?
The case studies I know the best are not in California. They're more in kind of the southeast, kind of the Gulf Coast areas. And in some ways, it's because they've been suffered the most damage, so they're being the most proactive and kind of in trying to solve that. California, nothing comes to mind of a municipality that is really doing it well yet. Again, I think, you know, Santa Cruz here, Monterey, Pacific Grove, also Pacifica up in San Francisco are starting to think along these lines. So those are probably where I would assume the first iterations of this might come from.
And then I know you're a vegan, and that kind of plant-based lifestyle, I know, is kind of at the core of some of your thinking about these projects and this broader theory. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So this is obviously more of a personal position. The center isn't, you know, taking any position on this. But, you know, I think, you know, let's take one of our, you know, anyone who's in ocean conservation, let's take Sylvia Earle. Right, everybody knows her. Listen to what Sylvia Earle says. She says what I say, which is don't eat seafood. That she does not believe that there is sustainable industrial seafood. She doesn't believe it. And she makes a deeper case. If you listen to her, I really recommend listening to the TED interview with her that came out a couple months ago. She makes a pretty detailed ethical case that these sea creatures are quite sentient and individual. You know, we think of fishing, it's just big, huge nets and millions of kind of all seemingly this identical fish kind of wriggling around and suffocating as we take them out of the water. And she's had, you know, 60 years of diving with these sea creatures and being spending weeks at a time with individual fish underwater and seeing unique personalities. And so she does a great job of kind of the ethics that these are not just kind of the bugs of the sea, right? That the creatures that we're eating here are pretty sophisticated. And so my thing, you know, my final point here is, if you really, really care about the marine environment, it's really hard to square that with a support for commercial fishing. I just have to say that. Fortunately, on an affirmative note, there are people, there's a couple companies that I'd like to mention. So there's Ocean Hugger Foods, there's Good Catch Foods, there's Finless Fish, which is a new company that doesn't have any products yet, but which is building, developing cell-based. So it will actually be real fish, but just grown cell-based, not in a, not fished in the sea. And then, of course, you have the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger, and you got a million products out there. And so you can kind of have your cake and eat it too. You don't, you know, I think we, you know, with 10 billion people on the planet, I just don't think we can eat wild seafood at the rates we're eating it and have anything left. And it gets just math, you know, it's just the math.
So just to recap, don't eat fish, don't live by the ocean and don't get used to the status quo of having these, these places.
Well, first of all, yeah, I'm going to reframe that in a positive way. Right. So the first thing is, I want to say these are recommendations. Everyone is free to do as they please. It's just, this is my scientific opinion here. But in terms of absolutely live near the ocean, but just not right on top of the ocean, mm-hmm. right? So I live, a mile away from the ocean. I think that probably most places in the U.S., a mile in, you can take a nice walk, stroll down to the beach. Yeah. I can still hear the waves crashing in the winter. So you can live near the beach, just not on the beach, right? And then in terms of what not to eat, I really do want to reframe that, which is I think people should experiment with and start exploring plant-based alternatives or some of the cell-based alternatives when they come out, like the finless fish. Try some of the, those products. And I think as you find products you like, then you will naturally reduce consumption. I like the affirmative framing much more than telling people what not to do, because that's what veganism and plant-based diets have been always, that's been the kind of Achilles heel, that it's kind of a deprivation and you're telling me what not to do.
Yeah.
And these days, again, you can have your cake and eat it too. Go to Whole Foods or any kind of store and look at all the millions of plant-based milks and ice creams and sausages and burgers, and Good Catch has plant-based crab cakes and all kinds of, fish fillet kind of products that taste amazing. And you put a little tartar sauce on that, have a couple beers. And to be honest, you're not really going to miss the crab cakes. You're not going to miss the calamari. So we're really lucky that we live in a technological age and in an age of abundance, whereas, Americans, we can kind of have it all. And so I don't want to leave on a kind of a deprivation mindset.
That's a way better note to end on.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Thanks very much for the time, Jason. It was good talking to you.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks very much again to Jason for making time to come on the podcast. For more information on his work, check out the Center for the Blue Economy at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. You can find him online at middlebury.edu. If you want to follow what I'm up to with California travel, I'm on Twitter at Greg R. Thomas. Or if you've got questions for me or suggestions for who I should bring on the pod, email me at gthomas@sfchronicle.com. Wild West is part of the San Francisco Chronicle Podcast Network. Find us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you like us, please throw us a rating and a review. See you next time.